She won't ask for it.
Okay, well, welcome everybody to lecture four of this year's Hinshelwood Lectures. I know what some of these words are, but not all of them, so we'll have to find out.
Thank you so much. So, today is the fourth lecture, and we're switching gears again, and we'll talk about something different. Still would be maybe a little bit of connection to what I was talking about before. But more specifically, what I want to cover today, and here is the slide showing it, is liquids on structured surfaces, more specifically water, even more specifically ice. I'm a physical chemist and I'm actually a crystallographer. I like everything crystalline. And I also talk about bacteria. And what you see on the background, if you think it's a snow piles, you're wrong. It's a picture that I've taken next to Harvard. These are cars. So you see a window, you see a mirror, and the obsession with ice, not only because it's a crystal for me, because in some places it's a real problem. So let's think about very simple, well-known, I'm sure that I'm not saying anything new to you, about liquids on surfaces. And what does it mean? Energetics or contact angles that these liquids would take when they're exposed to a solid surface. Of course, there is a contact angle, and to define a contact angle, we should look at solid, you should look at liquid, we should look at vapor. And depending on type of the surfaces, there are a couple of equations that define these contact angles, and not necessarily contact angle itself, but sometimes this contact angle with this, that is called the parent contact angle. And an ideal flat, and it's important that it's ideal flat, it's Young's equation. If you have a droplet of liquid on a structured surface, embedded in this structured surface, it's Wenzel equation. When you have structured surface, hydrophobic structured surface, the droplet is sitting on the tips of these structures, it's non-wetted state, it's Cassie-Baxter equation, and there is also a more general equation. In principle, this one and this one are exactly the same equation, and the idea is if you have chemically heterogeneous surface, each region contributes to the overall phobicity or felicity of this substrate, and depending on the contact angle of each of these regions, you will have the apparent contact angle for the droplet sitting on this heterogeneous surface. If I replace this chemically heterogeneous region, one of these regions, with air, I'll get from this that equation. So the most interesting part is, of course, not just simply hydrophobicity. So how to make surfaces that don't like water, which means that their contact angle is larger than 90 degrees, as simple as that definition. More interesting is, of course, superhydrophobic surfaces. It's non-wetting surfaces, and there are many things in nature, again, obsessively, showing you plants or water striders, butterflies, mosquitoes and butterflies, and all of them have the ability to shed water droplets for different purposes. For example, in the case of butterfly wings, if water will get in, these very delicate scales will collapse. In the case of water striders, if water will come in, they will just sink in water and they need to run on water. In the case of lotus leaf, it's just to keep the surfaces clean so that the water droplets whose angles are approaching 180 degrees can pick up dust and run away. Now, coming back more specifically about superhydrophobic surfaces, again, to these things to happen, to have this nearly round droplets of liquid on these surfaces, you really need this quasi-wetting state, which means you need to reduce in your chemically heterogeneous surface amount of solid. Even if solid is hydrophobic, it's sufficiently sticky, so that by reducing that, you really suspend your droplet on air, and if you can do that, it will be almost spherical in shape. Now, if it doesn't do it, it goes to Wenzel wetting, and you will see that it's a really detrimental part of everything when we think about potentially trying to mimic biological hydrophobic, superhydrophobic surfaces and use them for something important. We can make these structured surfaces. The only thing we need is a structure, ideally with a limited solid fraction, functionalize this surface with the hydrophobic molecules, so that entire surface is now hydrophobic and because of texture, presence of texture, becoming superhydrophobic. And it doesn't really matter how you do it. It could be regular, irregular. It could be open cell structure, closed cell structures. All of them, if they're hydrophobic, will show effect of superhydrophobicity. And just to show you right away how this works, if I compare hydrophilic surface, and here is a falling droplet on a hydrophilic surface, it spreads. This hydrophobic spreads as well and always stays in contact, just like in hydrophilic case. A little bit smaller contact area, but it's still in contact. Here is superhydrophobic surface. So the droplets bounce off the surface. Actually, they act as an oscillator, the harmonic oscillator on these surfaces. So something very interesting is happening on superhydrophobic surfaces. And let's explore it, and in particular, let's see if we can immediately switch from water. It's hydrophobicity, it's waterphobicity. Nobody said that if you get to ice, it will also show superhydrophobic, super icephobic properties. So let's talk about ice right away. Water is easy in every sense, at least from the point of view of repelling it from the surface. Ice is not that easy, and we do know how many problems ice can create for power outages, for plane crashes, for anything, for ice accumulation on the roofs of the buildings and then sliding on your head. So what is used now, current solutions for dealing with ice, is in fact solutions that are based on either chemistry or mechanics. So either you use chemicals for de-icing, or you heat, inflate, and get rid of accumulated ice in this way. So there is examples on aircraft wing. There is what is called this on the edge of the wing, this pneumatic part that expands, crashes ice. But there are still a lot of problems because these approaches need somebody to activate them. So you need a pilot, let's say, to respond to icing conditions and switch on the mechanical system. Or you need to spray your chemical that may prevent or reduce temperature at which ice will form. Now, if we can, and we hope we can, prevent ice formation, not to get rid of ice later on when it forms, but not to have ice formed at all, just like water would be repelled from superhydrophobic surfaces, that would be an amazing thing to achieve. So if we think about superhydrophobic surfaces, structured surfaces with hydrophobic coating, they may contribute to icephobicity in three ways. So first of all, in all these cases, if it stays in quasi state, it will only touch the tips of the underlying surface. There are three ways it contributes to potentially, in a good way, to our idea of what we want to do with that. So it's super hydrophobicity, because droplets would sit on the tips. It will actually contribute to thermal conditions of the surface. So if you have super cooled substrate, and the droplets that are not as cold as droplets themselves, and they land on a cold substrate, heat has to go through air interface, and it has very limited contact with the cold substrate. But also adhesion of ice. Even if ice forming, it's now attached in very small areas. So one can look at that and in many different ways. Interestingly enough, if you freeze, here is a structured surface. Here's just immediately seeing the difference between super hydrophobic and hydrophobic droplet. It's exactly the same surface, but part of this is silicon, this is structured silicon, different contact angles. If you freeze it and then you melt again, it stays in super hydrophobic state, which is very important that it doesn't transform in wetting of the surface. So if we think about thermal transfer in these surfaces, it's really interesting thing as well, because we hope that due to the fact that there is a thermal conductance in the surfaces and you have now air, they would contribute to differences in when these things would wet. Here is three droplets. This one is in the wenthal state. It freezes first. There's these three droplets. The substrate is being cooled. This one is, and time is running. This is almost immediately a lot of contact with the substrate. It's frozen. You will see very soon that this one, which is sitting on a flat surface, it's already frozen. And then the last one is the one that is in the Cassie state on the super hydrophobic surface. So there is definitely contribution to delay of when freezing takes place. You can go further and think about something that we covered before. In addition to that, if we talk about adhesion, I've shown you that you can form something on the surface. It's very easy to get rid of this stuff because the contact with the substrate and therefore adhesive force is so limited. So that has to contribute in a nice way. And the third one, and we can of course measure ice adhesion, and just to prove that it's not only the expectation, we've done the force measurements of ice adhesion to the surfaces, and the way that works is looking on the hydrophobic surface. Ice is really seriously attached to the surface. If it's super hydrophobic surface, you see, you cannot remove ice from hydrophobic surface. Its adhesion to the substrate is stronger than. If it's super hydrophobic surface, you remove it. It's order of magnitude reduced force that you need for that action. Now, let's go further. What I just shown you is that likely that super hydrophobic surfaces are energy efficient ice removal approach. I didn't say anything about whether ice will or will not form. The only thing I did mention that it may form a little later. So let's think about approaches. Can we not form ice on these surfaces? Now, if we think about it, at least in real conditions, there is the idea of static droplets on the surfaces. But in fact, most of this is falling rain, super cool droplets falling from the skies. So there is an impact of droplets, super cool droplets, on even colder substrate where ice formation actually takes place. So let's think about it now as a dynamic process, not just a droplet sitting on a surface. So let's see what can happen if we have now super hydrophobic surfaces and try to see how they work in dynamic conditions of falling, falling rain or falling droplets. The overall idea is that that thing that I've just shown you before, the hypothesis at least, you see that the droplet spreads on the surface, contracts, and leaves the surface. So the fact that not only it has limited contact on the tips of the structures, but it actually has limited time, something milliseconds that it is in contact with the substrate. If we think about crystallization process, every crystal to crystallize, there is induction time for nucleation. Crystals do not form immediately. So if the droplets can bounce off the substrate before crystallization takes place, before nucleation takes place, then there would be no ice formation on these surfaces because droplets would bounce off before they can freeze. And we can look at this process and compare, let's say, hydrophobic flat surfaces to exactly the same chemistry, superhydrophobic surfaces, and looking dynamics of droplet spreading, contraction, contact with the substrate, and test it at different temperatures. Just to show you again, maybe, half of my movies didn't play yesterday, but hydrophilic surface. This is minus 20 degrees C. It spreads and, of course, freezes on contact. Hydrophobic surfaces do not work. Spreads, but it's always in contact with substrate. So it is freezing, of course, as well. It never leaves the cold substrate. Superhydrophobic, it actually was able to leave the surface, minus 20 degrees surface, no ice left behind. And if you analyze this behavior and you look at the dynamics of this process, or even if somebody may say it's just one droplet, what if you have a constantly pouring rain on these surfaces? And again, I'm comparing hydrophilic surface, hydrophobic surface, and on the right is superhydrophobic surface. And with this is in this particular case is minus 15 C temperature of the substrate, minus 5 degrees C temperature of the supercooled droplet. And you could see in 10 minutes a lot of ice formed on a flat hydrophilic alumina. Enough. It's just at the beginning maybe it works, but it same ice accumulation on hydrophobic surface and nothing on superhydrophobic surface. So if I were to look at the dynamics of this process, and what I'm plotting here is, and my thing is not working that well, but I'm plotting the area of contact that the droplet has with the substrate as a function of time. As I said, if it can contract and leave faster than nucleation will take place, we may not have ice at all. In red, there is a graph for 20 degrees C, minus 15 C, and you see that the droplets actually fully leave the surface. No ice is formed at all. And in fact, if I add here other temperatures in this range, they will all follow exactly the same dynamics. Doesn't matter that temperatures are a broad range of temperatures. But if I go now, here is if you look in the red line with minus 25 degrees C, it still follows at the beginning the same trajectory, and at a certain moment it stops because it was frozen on contact. So it retracts a little and then stops at this moment, and here is at this point, there is ice forming. For comparison in blue, I show hydrophobic surfaces. They, of course, have completely different way of interacting with the substrate as a function of time and temperature. So they have completely different behavior because the temperature of the substrate is different and thermal transfer there is different from superhydrophobic surfaces. But most interesting here is that they all collapse to the same line, and this is where we can have a behavior, thank you, behavior where they can have ice-phobic behavior, where no ice will form. Again, I'll show you now what we're actually looking at. What we're looking at is this area of contact. On top, we have hydrophobic surfaces. So it begins to spread, and there's this, here is ice forming. And as a function of temperature, this one frozen upon, not even upon retraction, upon spreading, at minus 25, it was pinned, still a little bit of water, and then this freezes. Here is behavior of superhydrophobic surfaces. Minus 15, plus 20, anything here, up to about minus 25. When it spreads, but stays in contact for too long at that temperature, and ice will actually form. So there is a nice thing related to the fact that if you compare flat surface and then you melt it, then superhydrophobic runs off the surface very fast, and on hydrophobic surface it will just melt and stay in contact every time. So removal of ice on the surface, the moment you begin to warm it up, is much faster, seconds that it takes for this to go. So let's a little bit talk about modeling this phenomenon and to see whether it is that promising, whether indeed, experimentally we've seen that up to about minus 22 experimentally degrees C of the temperature of the substrate, for the droplet of minus 5 degrees temperature, no ice formation is observed. The way we can look at that is actually looking on the pinning transition using three approaches. We have to look at the wetting dynamics, what happens with time with contact angle. We should look at the thermal transport and looking at the interface temperature. And we need to use nucleation theory to know what is happening, and in particular, how ice formation is a function of solid fraction on your surface and how it's related to contact angle. That is dynamic contact angle, changing all the time. Remember that if your ice caps are forming, or at least a little bit of nucleation takes place, hydrophobicity, hydrophilicity of the surface is changing, and also surface area is changing. So a lot of different things are changing. With wetting dynamics, it's actually a really nice harmonic oscillator that spreads, contracts, leaves the surface. If we look at the thermal transport, we need to look at least we've done it by using 1D, one-dimensional heat conduction on the surfaces and thinking about transient interfacial temperature. So really, there is a temperature of the substrate, there is air in between, there is droplet of another temperature, looking on thermal diffusivities of the surface, and then to see what happens. And, as I mentioned at the end, actually combine it with classical heterogeneous nucleation theory and look at that and think about the fact that now, in our equation of motion, the force term all consists of known parameters if you introduce the things from the other two approaches. The modeling, then, and the way I present it here, is done in the following way. If I look at the radius of a droplet, and what we do need is for this radius to go to zero. So the droplet has to leave the surface. So if we look at the force that is needed for that for this droplet to leave, if we look at the interfacial force that is acting on the surface. So if the force is higher than zero and radius is getting to zero before force gets to zero, the droplets would leave the surface. if the force, and this is when transition will take place, if the droplets gets to zero size at the time when the force is zero, this is the time, and you could see it in this image, small bridge of this droplet, it's about almost left, but no, ice bridge has formed. It's exactly this condition. And then really ice formation will take place when force gets to zero before droplet retracts from the surface. And if you do this, you can find that theoretically, with our way we looked at this, at about minus 20 degrees C, there would be a transition to ice formation. That's wonderful. Which means that it may work. This positive mood will change very soon, trust me. So it also tells you if you have lower surface, solid surface fraction, it should work even better because you are even more super hydrophobic, but it's really not true because you have impacting droplets and there is a detrimental effect of the pressure instability. If you have an open cell structure, this one, for example, has a higher contact angle than this one. So it's more super hydrophobic. But there's so much open space that when droplet hits the surface, it actually transitions to the Wenzel state, and that is a wetting transition. And now it would actually have even more contact with the substrate. A little bit that we can do with that, we can change the open cell structures to closed cell structures. And what happens then? Then you would have a different behavior because of this entrapped air layer that acts as a cushion for this droplet. It needs higher pressure to be squeezed into these structures. And indeed, it's true. And there are other advantages of closed cell structures. You can make them by roll, you can get to larger feature sizes, and they're definitely more mechanically robust because it's interconnected wall structure. So everything nice and beautiful, very glorious, it can work, it should work if humidity is almost non-existent. So that's the difference between an, I hope, elegant theoretical study and experimental study, and real world. The moment the humidity is a contribution to the entire phenomenon that we just discussed, it doesn't work at all. Not only doesn't work, it actually, and here is a work by Professor Varanasi, showing that, as I mentioned, if it's humidity, then you have condensation. You have frosting, not necessarily icing effect, which means that your nucleation of vapor phase can take place anywhere on your surface. So ice is now forming all around your structures, and instead of being isophobic and easy to clean, it becomes much stickier and much more difficult for ice to be removed. Okay, it's not working in real life. Now, I'll show you another example when it's not working. And there will be more in the next lecture. But let's now think about bacteria. And again, we think about structured surfaces. There's a lot of studies by now. And thinking about exactly the same. If you have a surface where droplets are sitting on top, and let's say it's contaminated with bacteria or whatever it is, it has very limited contact to the substrate, maybe these creatures are not going to do anything on these surfaces. Now, let's just talk about bacteria altogether. They're horrible. I don't have to... sometimes there are nice ones, but in most cases, they are bad for medical devices, for marine vessels. Seawater desalination is affected, dental plaque. Some data over here on this slide. Just for those of you who do not know the life cycle of bacteria, Bacteria alone, in most cases, not in all cases, but in most cases, are not dangerous. It's biofilms that is dangerous. It's a community of bacterial films that make a structure on top of the substrate, and there is a cycle how they go through different stages and colonize the interfaces. So in fact, it's probably not that critical to work or try to make materials that repel bacteria, but maybe to repel. I'll just turn it off maybe. Thank you. So now if we look at the more physicochemical characteristic of this life cycle and what happens with bacteria interacting with the surface, and if we look at the as the time progresses and we'll look at the chemical and physical interactions, at the very beginning there's van der Waals forces, attractive, repulsive, this is physical chemistry group, we know that, nice, may even work. Then there is hydrophobic interactions, and there is attraction, and then we go to yet more and more things happening. But even more importantly, what I want to mention somewhere between the first hour, what bacteria does is changing your surface chemically. So it doesn't matter what you deposited on your surface, hoping that you can repel it chemically. What happens with time is that bacteria will lie down a layer of its own goo and then use it as a carpet to which to attach. So as much as I always hope that chemistry plays a very big role, in fact, it's really conditioned by something else very soon and masked by bacteria and other organisms, certainly with biological things very fast. So maybe, again, surface topography, maybe thinking about stiffness of the substrate, maybe think about dynamic substrate, as I mentioned in the last lecture, just like sea urchins do, dynamically not letting, creating flow that doesn't allow bacteria to settle on the surface. But just to show you again that doesn't matter which chemistry you use, I can put much more on this slide. And here is hydrophobic, hydrophilic, whatever surface. At the beginning, you see some differences, but in 24 hours, all of them are fully coated by bacteria. Now, let's go back to at least one hope. And this was related to exactly the same experiment that we had for ice, or at least where our hope was. Let's talk about at least splashes of contaminated medium. So if it's a splash, just like we hope that if contact is short enough, ice wouldn't form. Bacteria also needs to grab to the surface. That's a process. Machinery doesn't work right away. So just like there, we may hope that if the time that the droplet spends on the surface is short enough for bacteria to attach, then the surfaces might be bacteria-free on dynamic conditions, not on static droplets. And to show that it may work, and it actually works beautifully, we were having this dripping of highly contaminated medium on the surface. Then, after droplets would leave, whatever was on the surface was put in an agar plate and waiting for a couple of hours, actually more, for days, depends on which species we were testing, to see whether bacteria will form on these surfaces. The sad result for those who think about surgery as a not clean environment, I hope it's not happening anymore, that on control surfaces, non-pattern, flat, hydrophobic, or hydrophilic, it doesn't matter, substrates, after dripping, dynamic dripping. So droplet is in contact with the substrate for a very short time. And still it's enough when you take this substrate and put it in the agar plate, it's fully overgrown by bacterial colonies. Superhydrophobic surface, and here is one example. This is, thank God, if you pattern it, and sometimes color can tell you where your patterned regions, because you can pattern it in such a way that it has interference with the wavelengths of visible light. But it's also nice that you have control right there. So if now we pour liquid on this one, dripping on that slide, and then putting it on an agar plate, of course it's a negative of this side because it's upside down now, you could see a lot of bacteria on the where the flat part was and a clean surface where superhydrophobic part. Yet another example of exactly the same result. A lot of bacteria, noble bacteria. So it does work. But it's only when it's dripping on a very short contact. We started to we continued our studies in this area because we still hope something can be made. And in particular, that if the size is here, that bacteria may not even fit in these. If you also correlate it with the size of bacteria, maybe it would work very nicely. And here is the results with flat surface, structured surface, and using E. coli as another example, but static condition. So the substrate is exposed to the E. coli medium or a droplet with E. coli. And what we see over here, and I will show you more specific quantitative data, is that, oh yes, they form on the surface. Not only that they form on the surface, they actually form on the surface worse than a flat one. Now, what we found in these studies is an interesting thing, that not only that bacteria changes the surface by changing the chemistry of the surface, laying down something, some proteins or polysaccharides that it likes to attach to, but in fact, it has an action of actively force the surface to wet. If you look at this video, I hope you see some bacteria there. It comes in and it's forcing it here to wet. Now another will come in, and through twisting of flagella, it forces the liquid into, creates vortex, and forces the liquids in. So not only, it doesn't even wait for chemistry to be laid down, it uses physics to bring liquid inside. And the moment the liquid is inside, unpleasant thing happens. So this is just another movie of how they move and how they explore the surface, change it very significantly. And then let's first look at that graph. The gray line, let's look at the black line, wild type, regular E. coli bacteria. Most of the studies, most of the studies, if you use non-bactericidal surfaces and you use structured surfaces, somehow reported beautiful results with superhydrophobic surfaces, but they would only show first 2 hours of the performance. And they don't lie. If I look at the ratio of biomass as a biomass on the structured surface versus flat, so if it's one, it's the same biomass is accumulated. If it's higher, it's more. We could see that in the first couple of hours, the biomass accumulated is less than one. So indeed, structured surface works better than the flat. However, after 2 hours, it accumulates much more than the flat control. It's more than one. There's also a genetically modified one that where we removed flagella from these bacteria. it's working better than flat surface, a little better. But honestly, who cares where it's contaminated, 100% or 80%? It's still a really bad result. And it's all because of this wetting front, this non-wetting surface becomes wetted surface. And at that moment, it actually explores more than just the tips. Every point in your structured surface becomes a point of contact. And you create a really bad biofilm that is very difficult to remove. In fact, let's put a whole range of stuff now on this slide. We talked about ice, but let's throw more. Let's throw dirty windows, solar panels, graffiti, marine fouling, oil transport, infestation, an all range of medical situations. In all these, very different. I'm not claiming they're in any way the same phenomena. But again, if I reduce it to something that I can find common in all these systems, there is an accumulation of unwanted material on the surface, and it would be nice to prevent it. Different materials, different surfaces, but we don't need these things to be accumulated at the interfaces. Now, superhydrophobic surfaces sometimes are used as an example of bioinspiration from lotus leaf. They are often even called lotus-inspired surfaces, to try to use them in all of these examples. But this is honestly a wrong approach. And as you know by now, I do a lot of biological studies, but also trying to think what can be used in the real world. The reason we shouldn't even think about lotus leaf as inspiration for any of these systems is that evolution made these surfaces super hydrophobic, water-phobic. Not ice-phobic, not oil-phobic, not bacteria-phobic. So machinery that evolved to deal with that was actually developed to deal with high surface tension liquid water, not other liquids. And if now we look at a whole range of real conditions, if we have low surface tension liquid, if you don't do very special things, superhydrophobicity fails. If you have high temperature, superhydrophobicity fails because even water with temperature reduces its surface tension. If you have high pressure, it goes to benzyl state, becomes sticky. If you have high humidity, icing condition, biological medium, it all fails. Unless you do something really serious. But should we? It's just probably a wrong inspiration. And this butterfly that will become a star of my next three lectures, actually, especially the last one, is here for some reason. First of all, to show that when we drop water on the right wing, it's super hydrophobic. When we drop alcohol, it didn't evolve to deal with alcohol rains. Water comes in, wets the surface. In this particular case, as I will talk in the last lecture, it also changes color, but it wets the surface. It cannot sustain its phobic state with a different liquid. So we definitely need a better strategy. And let's think about better strategy. So superhydrophobic strategy, the idea for superhydrophobic strategy was based on trying to make the contact angle as high as possible. So as the droplet becomes almost spherical, it will roll off the surface and hopefully this way pick up whatever it can pick up and leave the surface clean. However, even if you have flat surface, there would be always some defects. And in fact, instead of just contact angle, maybe much better to describe the surface in terms of contact angle hysteresis, which is the difference between advancing contact angle on the inclined surface and receding contact angle. You can measure it in many different ways. But if you have pinning on your surface, and it could be due to different things, chemical interaction, just roughness of the surface, then you actually will have very high contact angle hysteresis. But let's think about a case that I don't care whether it's hydrophobic or hydrophilic. However, so I don't care what is the contact angle. But what if the contact angle hysteresis is zero? It means that at any angle other than zero, the droplet will slide off the surface because it would be no resistance, no friction at this interface. So maybe, in fact, we should think about minimizing liquid pinning and therefore hysteresis on the surface for extreme liquid, general liquid repellency. Let's go back to bacteria, because some time ago when we were studying, actually still hoping that superhydrophobicity can help, we noticed something interesting. So we were growing this Bacillus subtilis biofilm, and it's such a nice structure. Oh my God, it's amazing. Then we found in the literature that even if you use other bacteria, it's not exactly this one, but if you use and look at the living bacteria, red is living, green is dead, 30 minutes exposure to bleach, still living, 1 hour exposure to bleach, a little bit of dead cells, still living cells. And we decided to look at this a little bit more carefully, and the curious observation was that these surfaces are structured and hydrophobic, so they are superhydrophobic. But they're actually not just superhydrophobic, they're more than superhydrophobic. They are omniphobic in a sense that it repels everything. In particular, if I compare, let's say, Bacillus subtilis biofilm, or any other biofilm for that matter, and I place on it a ethanol droplet, it doesn't go in. While if I put an ethanol droplet on Teflon, and even structured Teflon, or any, most of the superhydrophobic surfaces, it will wet the surface. Now, when we were trying to think about what is the reason for that, we were replicating its texture and thinking that texture itself has a key, but any replicants with exactly the same texture, with exactly the same chemistry, didn't work, actually worked just like Teflon. And if we look at the phobicity at different ethanol concentrations, and we're looking on the contact angle of the droplet on the surface, it's not wetting, up to 90% of alcohol in your mixture. So, liquids do not penetrate bacterial films. While if you look on the control of a superhydrophobic surface, Teflon in particular, as you increase the low surface tension components, it wets it more and more and more. In fact, you can do it and look at the different types of these surfaces to see what is responsible for that. These are not wild types that are missing some component of its structure. But the wild type itself has this plateau where it's omniphobic. And only if you get your liquids, low surface tension liquids, in this concentration, only then you can penetrate the structures. And just to show it with imaging, if you go into This is wild type. This is the type that is missing a certain organic component in it. And you look at liquid, organic liquid going through, you could see that here it goes through somewhere, but not everywhere else. So all these black parts would be actually filled with living bacteria, while on the type that is missing a key component, and I don't want to talk about which one is now, but you can read it in our PNAS paper, it would be immediately destroyed. In fact, it doesn't have to be alcohol. If you look in Clorox bleach, Lysol, Hibiclen, drain opener, whatever you do, they do not actually affect bacterial film. Which means there's something else that we can learn from nature, and I want to show this example and actually finish with this example. Yet another system. On a dry day, this carnivorous plant is fine. Every insect is running around. On a wet day, they slide in. They cannot stay put on the surface. So it's a carnivorous plant, it's a pitcher plant, it needs to eat. The appetite is only on a wet day. So compared to other carnivorous plants that at least have to capture their food, they don't have to do anything. So it's passively somehow catching the food in some conditions. So let's take a look what is happening there. In fact, if we think it's a surface, it's true. And then actually surface texture, in fact, is very similar to lotus leaf or other superhydrophobic surfaces. But there is a very significant difference. Geometrically, it's the same. Feature sizes, it's the same. But it's hydrophilic, not hydrophobic. So due to the same wetting phenomena that makes hydrophobic surface superhydrophobic when you structure it. If you structure hydrophilic surface, it becomes superhydrophilic. And superhydrophilic means that if you have a droplet with a certain contact angle, finite contact angle, if you have now a structured surface, it will form a film with a contact angle of nearly zero. So this is exactly what is happening here with the structured surface picking up water from in the wet day. It forms a film of water on the surface. Now, if we think about the ways insects attach, they, of course, have more trivial hooks for mechanical interaction with the substrate. But more importantly, this thing is the pouch of secreted oil. And if you look at these ants, at the time a wet water film is formed, it protects the underlying surface. It's not seen by the plant, by the insects. So what is actually created is the oil-water interface. There is no contact points with the solid itself. And of course, liquid-liquid interfaces are slippery, and everything slides as they do on the water slide. This approach is, in fact, not only in this pitcher plant. It's everywhere. Let's think about what is happening in our gut. The surface of the wall of the gut has this structured surface that is again very similar structure-wise to structured surfaces that we see in hydrophobic, superhydrophobic materials. But whatever is out there in your gut going through never sees, unless you're sick, never sees the wall itself because it's protected by a mucus layer. Pretty much the same is true for our eyes. There is always a layer of water protecting it from dust. Fish moves fast because it creates a layer of mucus that reduces drag. And this is the pitcher plant again with an idea of the idea overall is, and this would be my last slide, is let's think about a little bit counterintuitive approach to design of the surfaces. We know that rough surfaces have high friction, but let's use structured surfaces to actually make ultra-smooth surfaces, defect-free surfaces, by having a substrate that has a certain porosity, functionalizing it in such a way that it will like a lubricant, doesn't have to be water as nature does it. Could be, if you want to work with olive oil, your lubricant could be olive oil and you just functionalize your substrate to be hydrophobic. Then this substrate would hold your olive oil. It would be oleo, super oleophilic. It will hold this. And you create now lubricant interface, fluid interface, and I will talk in the next lecture how to characterize it and when it is stable. And if you do it properly, any liquid material would slide off. And we call these things slips, which is slippery, liquid infused, porous surfaces, and everything slips on them. And with that, I will be happy to take your questions. Absolutely, you're right. But let's be optimistic even before they do it. But that's true. At least everything we know about that, they always find a way. There could be some changes in either organic or the way they approach surface, or maybe they will all develop flagella, even those that don't have flagella at this moment. But let's be positive, at least a little.
Biofilm
itself, their own omniphobicity.
Yeah.
We believe that in fact it's the same mechanism that I will going to talk about in the next lecture, which is it's not topography alone, it's not hydrophobicity of this surface alone, because that works with water, but in fact the ability of them to wet the surface and having this liquid film that provides non-wetting behavior for anything else. So we haven't yet fully proven that. But in fact, any time we see that the surface truly repelling liquid matter, it's when the surface is coated with the liquid, and liquids by definition defect-free. The surfaces do not have roughness of any kind. So we think that that's the idea, and the ability to actually recreate this liquid layer and coat its sole living surface with that with this liquid.
Freezing temperature of water decreases with the droplet size. So has anybody tried to do that? For example, combination of hydrophobic and hydrophilic airs that would split the droplet to smaller ones. Never freeze actually, or some active hairs that would tear off the blood.
That's very good. But indeed, very small droplets never freeze. But small droplets also have Laplace pressure and always go into these structures. They always wet. So even they never freeze, but then you have enough of them, they coalesce. And they form sufficiently large puddle of water that will freeze. So in fact, it's a very good question. Making droplets smaller helps something, but actually makes other things worse.
One sub-question, what about silver hairs that can bacteria
You're talking about silver?
Yes, silver.
Yes. If we go into entire biocidal range, that's another question of how much of that we want or we should use. I may talk about it next lecture even more. We're looking now on the barnacle and muscle adhesion to the slippery surfaces. And in most cases, what is now used on boats is copper-containing paints. Could be silver-containing paints for the said matter, but it would be very expensive paint. And guess what? Even barnacles develop just the similar as resistance that bacteria develop for antibiotics. In certain places in the world where there's too much of this paint, barnacles don't care anymore. In particular, in Florida, they actually really love to attach to copper-containing surfaces. So yes, metals may work. TBT, tributyl tin, is banned already for 20 years, but it worked beautifully. Nothing attaches because everything dies. So yeah, it might be a way if you want them to be dead. Yes, and very good question. And here where chemistry is becoming very important and the correlation between chemical character of the substrate with the liquid that you use as your lubricant. Now imagine that your dust has high affinity to your lubricant. It will go inside the lubricant, but it would be inside. Lubricant still would be outside this. So if you just want to prevent it from contamination and optical properties is not something you care about, that's fine. This dust will come in and settle on the surface and the slipperiness will be the same. If the particles have different affinity to your lubricant, let's say lubricant's hydrophobic and particles are hydrophilic or the other way around, they would be washed away. Just like anything else, and will not have the ability to penetrate the lubrication layer.
Okay, with that, I invite you back on Monday for the 5th of this series, and there'll be one more on Tuesday, but for now, thank you, Anna Woman.